So three Sunday mornings ago, feels like almost 10,000 years to me now, we looked at the end of Psalm 95 as we were looking at worship and what Psalm 95 teaches about it. And we looked at that last part of it where God's messenger says, "Today, if you hear God's voice, do not harden your hearts." So this morning, what I want to do is explore some of the ways in which that voice that is spoken of here can come to us through His Word. Not all of them, but just some of them. And to do that, I'd like to read 2 Samuel 12, the first 14 verses, and then over to James chapter 1, verses 22 to 24. And as Sean already mentioned, this happens after the whole thing with Uriah being killed on purpose or being put in a dangerous situation on purpose by David the king so that he would be killed so that David could then claim Bathsheba as his wife and sort of cover up or hide the adultery that had been committed. So here's what happens. And I model my work as an STM after what Nathan does here. The Lord sent Nathan to David. When he came to him, he said, "There were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb he had bought. He raised it and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food, drank from his cup, and even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come to him. Instead, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him. David burned with anger against the man and said to Nathan, 'As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die. He must pay for the lamb four times over because he did such a thing and he had no pity.' Then Nathan said to David, 'You are that man.' This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says." And I want you to hear God agonizing as he says this, "I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave your master's house, palace, to you, and your master's wives into your arms. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah, and if all this had been too little, I would have given you even more. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword and took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now, therefore, the sword will never depart from your house because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own." This is what the Lord says. "Out of your own household, I'm going to bring calamity upon you. Before your very eyes, I will take your wives and give them to one who is close to you, and he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. You did it in secret, but I will do this thing in broad daylight before all Israel." Then David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." Nathan replied, "The Lord has taken away your sin. You are not going to die. But because by doing this you have made the enemies of the Lord show utter contempt, the son born to you will die." And it's interesting for you, if you want to read more before and after this, to think about it some more later today. But that's where we're going to stop there for now. And then we go to James 1, verses 22 to 24. "Do not merely listen to the word," merely listen, "and so deceive yourselves. Do what it says. Anyone who listens to the word but does not do what it says is like a person who looks at his face in a mirror and, after looking at himself, goes away and immediately forgets what he looks like. But the man who looks intently into the perfect law that gives freedom and continues to do this, not forgetting what he has heard, but doing it, he will be blessed in what he does. If any of you have read the Today devotional already so far today, it's actually related to this, which is always a neat providential coincidence. So David was living with the effects of unacknowledged, unfaced sin in his life when the prophet Nathan came and told him a story. The story was like a mirror held up to David, in front of David. But he did not know what he was seeing, what he was looking at. The story had a rich man stealing a precious thing from a poor man. He was abusing his power as a rich man. And that is, in fact, what David had done. And David, as we know from some of the Psalms that he wrote about this, as we heard, was struggling inside himself, feeling in his soul and spirit the rotting effect of his own abuse of power and his own taking action outside of the bounds of what a king was appointed by God to do. Certainly not use his power to his own advantage. No, a king was to enforce justice and fairness and to protect the vulnerable for God's name's sake. That's what they were supposed to do. Having a mirror held up like that, David unloaded the vile anger festering inside of him onto the man in the story Nathan told. But David's anger was really, certainly I've come to understand, a self-loathing that was inside of him. From the smoldering of his rotting spirit, he declares the man should die. And Nathan says, well, my story is a mirror. You are looking at yourself. The Bible and its accounts, its narratives, its stories, and the people in them can function as mirrors for us to look into as well. Any good story can do that, but the Bible stories have an extra layer of that. One of the things the Nathan and David portion can mirror for us is the danger of unacknowledged and unconfessed sin. Sin, we don't talk about it much anymore, and I don't really even like to use the word, but sin, in the standard definition of the church, is any action outside of God's aim for us, or even an inaction could qualify also. Any action that is not done out of a balanced love for God, self, and neighbor. Such sin rots us from the inside out, as the Psalms reveal. And if we've not learned to see how it does that, and not learned to see that sin and to seek it out, if we've not learned to then confess it as well, and we have not learned to work on changing that inner part of us, what I call heart change, then the poison of that sin, the toxicity of that sin, will carry us further and further and further from God's hopes and intentions for us. And that's the journey David was on when this happened. It will carry us away from full relationship with God. We will not be proper and full images of God anymore. We will lose the ability to reflect or to mirror God to the world, which is also what is done by Bible characters when they are serving God. We've looked at some of those unfaced sin patterns in our time together so far, and almost every sermon I preach, I'm presuming you've heard all the ones before. I know that's not maybe accurate, but I presume that. Otherwise, I feel like I have to explain all the ones that I did before every time I talk about something. But those of you who know those sermons will remember how we looked at Adam hiding in the garden. So he knows something's wrong and he goes and hides with Eve. We looked at the blame shifting that they did when God challenged them. Oh well, you know, and all of that. And we've looked at Cain's unwillingness to acknowledge that he was on the wrong track, even when God came to him and said, "You better get a check on this, or something terrible is going to happen." And Cain, wah, and away we went. First murder. So right from the very beginning of the Bible, even in the first family as a mirror to us, we do well to look into them to see ourselves better. And when we see their blame shifting, to turn the mirror on us and to ask ourselves, when can I catch myself blame shifting or hiding or in denial about ugliness that's living inside of me? When we read Scripture with our eyes and ears open and with our heart open to what God has to teach us, we will at times find ourselves reflected in a Bible character we know we should not be finding ourselves in. I know of someone who was shocked. They were studying Herod in preparation for Advent and Christmas, and who was shocked to be finding in Herod a behavior pattern they themselves had in their own lives. A need to control everything about their environment so that nothing could threaten them. And this person was shocked to feel that close to Herod when we all kind of know from childhood on that Herod's a bad guy. So this kind of looking in the mirror of Scripture is precisely part of what James was writing about in our other passage. There's more to it than I'm describing this morning, but I have limited time to explain to you. So James writes, "Do not merely listen, do not merely let the words go in one ear and out the other, and so deceive yourself. Stay in your denial. Do what the words say. Follow the directives of the words. Anyone who listens to the word but it has no effect on them, does not do what it says, is like a person who looks at his face in the mirror, or her face in a mirror, and as soon as they're not looking at the mirror, they forget what they look like." There once was a mother who had a very young son, just about to come out of toddler age. And this mother recognized that the son was about old enough to begin to learn to clean his own face before meals, not just his hands. So one day before supper, the mom lifted the boy up to the bathroom mirror, one of those big full wall mirrors, so that he could see the mess on his face for himself. And there it was, a beaming face with bits of the batter from the chocolate cake he had helped her make at the corners of his mouth. A purple Kool-Aid mustache over his upper lip, and various other blotches and unidentifiable stains on his cheeks. She said, "Do you see how dirty that face is?" And he nodded, "Yes." Now, the mom was quite aware that just putting the child down after that moment of insight would immediately erase his memory of the dirty face, and the child would just speed off to some other adventure. That in itself is like the passage from James that we're thinking about. He looks in the mirror, but as soon as he can't see the dirty face in the mirror anymore, he forgets what he saw and is no longer concerned at all about it. So, because this was a wise mom, to prevent that very thing from happening, the mother hands the boy a warm, damp cloth. Does anyone here still know those as dookies? Yeah? I don't know how many generations that word will be passed on before it's completely lost, but I deliberately say warm washcloth, a warm, damp cloth, while he's still up there in front of the mirror. She then asks him, "So what can we do about that dirty face?" And what the child did next is what we're going to look at in the rest of this message. The child took the cloth from the parent and proceeded to try and clean the face it saw on the mirror. That's what we all do in real life. Or we tend to, until we learn different. We try to clean the dirt off the mirror we see it in. But we forget that the dirt is really on our own faces. Using that kind of a method, we can clean that mirror as often as we feel like we want to. Or even get rid of all mirrors in our lives. But the dirt remains on our faces. Isn't that true for us, all of us, as well? Are we not often most bothered by others who have our faults? How many of us, who maybe like to talk a lot, get irritated by others who like to talk a lot? Right? And you can think of many other things. How many parents don't work doubly hard if they have children, work doubly hard to prevent or even expunge a bad habit that they have from their children? Often the child that has our faults, if we are parents, is the one we are the hardest on. We're trying to wipe our faults out of their lives. And this can apply to family members, extended family members, to co-workers, and so on. It's quite something to learn that the moment you feel irritated by someone else's behavior, to stop and not just think nasty thoughts about that person, but to right away go to the place where you're asking, what dirt is on my face that causes me to be irritated by the dirt on the other person? And you will find, as many have, that you've become a lot less concerned about dirt on other people's faces and more concerned to try and find your own. What we hide from ourselves, we will project onto our child, our sibling, or our neighbor, and we will try to destroy it there. One of the subjects of discussion in Grand Rapids, I can't remember whether it was the SDM conference or the regional pastors conference, was a quote by someone who said that the clerical collar with its little white block in the front there is a screen onto which people project all of their nasty thoughts. So one of the aspects that we talked about is that if a person's had a bad experience with a pastor and they meet a pastor, they will deal with that pastor as if it was the one before. And you will, as a pastor or as anyone, if this applies anywhere, wonder where in the world this animosity came from, but it was from something else. All of this becomes a form of hating your neighbor as yourself. As long as you insist on cleaning up the other person, you are hating your neighbor as you really hate yourself, but don't recognize. Doing that does as much good as trying to clean the mirror when the dirt is on our faces. And we have at least two key mirrors that function this way in our lives. People in Bible stories can be and are mirrors for us, but all the people we encounter can be that as well. And often shifting the burden of blame and avoiding personal responsibility is done by criticizing or being angry with anyone that we find who reflects our dirt. See, criticizing others solves two problems at once for us as guilty individuals. And next Sunday, it is my hope to look at Matthew 18 and teach us some new ways that the Bible shares of doing something else instead. But first of all, criticizing others takes our mind off of uncomfortable thoughts about ourselves. And secondly, then it focuses the blame of our failures on someone else as well. Criticism of others who have similar sins or dirt on the face easily serves as a cover-up for our own guilt, anxiety, and self-hatred. And yes, I say self-hatred deliberately. It's what I've come to see. David is experiencing self-hatred leading into his meeting with Nathan. There's this thing fermenting inside of him. And God sends the prophet Nathan. And I like to, every time I read this, I like to wonder if Nathan actually knew the purpose of the story or if he just felt that he had to tell that story and he didn't know what was going to happen next. I prefer the second one. Both are possible. God sends the prophet Nathan to challenge and expose what's actually going on inside of David. And Nathan does it in this wonderfully wise and unique way. He tells the story. He does not go directly to David, grab him by the lapels, and say, "You are a sinner." How effective would that have been? And in the story, Nathan held up a mirror in front of King David, and King David certainly recognized immediately what was wrong with the image in the mirror. And David's reaction to the story is very significant in revealing what's going on inside of him. First of all, his outrage at what the man had done, if you're just thinking of it legally, right? His outrage at what the man had done was completely hyperbolic. It was completely overzealous. It was way over the top. The Old Testament law did require the man to pay back 4 sheep for his injustice. So that would have been an appropriate response. But he starts it off by saying the man deserves to die. Anyone who does this kind of thing deserves to die. So he shows his rage, his inner rage. That's evidence that self-hatred was smoldering inside of David. And he lashed out at another man who had, in the story, abused his power, but his own burning self-hatred was the fuel of his anger. And he didn't know it. We become very unhappy internally when we do not have a way of dealing with our sin, dealing with the dirt on our faces and in our hearts. In fact, we secretly begin to hate ourselves without even knowing it. And as we go on that journey of hating ourselves, we of course move farther from relationship with God. When we carry our sin around and don't cleanse ourselves of it, we end up like David in the first part of our passage, or like Cain, angry and downcast. Remember those words? Which he remained until he killed his brother, and then he recognized the truth of what God had said. And that self-hatred stands in the way of our obedience to the command to love God above all else with everything we've got and love our neighbor as ourselves. And so a vicious, self-destructive cycle can begin, a cycle that only Satan derives any pleasure from and which causes God sadness and grief as the relationship with him starts slipping away by our own doing. David was outraged at the story of a man who had failed where David himself had failed, but had not yet seen or acknowledged. But when Nathan says, "You are the man in the story. You are the man that has abused your power given by God for your own pleasure, and you've used it to ease your own conscience by having a husband killed," when that is stated by Nathan, David hears. And the word goes directly to his heart. And he sees. And he admits. And he finds relief even in the admitting. And he finds, as Nathan speaks, forgiveness of his sin. David had hidden his sin from himself and was deeply unhappy because of it. He remained unhappy until the consequences of the sin were gone. Make sure you notice that. There were still consequences, even though he had been forgiven. Very important theological lesson. The son born of David's adultery with Bathsheba eventually died as part of these consequences, as part of the punishment. And David was distraught, if you read further into the chapter, until the child had died. And then he got up and he ate and drank and took up living to the best of his ability again. But a portion of David's relief began immediately once the sin was out in the open and had been confessed with him, by him. It's a wonderful testimony to God's grace and forgiveness that the next child, born to David and Bathsheba, a proof that God doesn't hold things against us forever, was Solomon. Bathsheba was Solomon's mother. And all this, making things better, revealed in the Old Testament there, was before Jesus came and made things even better yet. David found God's grace and healing active in his life when he confessed that he had dirt on his face, sin in his life. But after that, scars did remain in David's life. Since David's time, Jesus the Christ has come and made the ultimate sacrifice, suffering and dying, even though innocent, the only innocent that truly ever lived. And since David's time, Jesus came and wiped away the burden of all the sins and the dirt that you and I might carry outside and inside ourselves. And he did that so God's grace could be even more evident in life, our life, than it was in David's time. Jesus cleared the way so that none of us have to carry sin dirt inside of us or on our faces. To help us do that, he's waiting for us to look in the mirrors around us, and particularly the mirror of his word, and recognize the dirt in our lives and admit it to him so that he can come with a warm washcloth, so that Jesus can come with a warm washcloth, or if you understand what it is, a dookie, and wipe it out of your lives. So I want to urge you to begin looking into this mirror in a new way, this book, and asking God where you might be hiding sins or unaware of them. David's experience shows us that God is both just and merciful, and if we confess our sin before him, he will be kind and forgiving in the face of a contrite and penitent, as Sean pointed out to us, heart. Ask God to show you where the dirt is on your face. Ask trusted friends. Just like this morning, people were trusting me enough to take the risk of trying to tell me there's something on your face. You can do that with each other in a speaking the truth in love way, and help become a cleansed community. Help each other. You might be surprised at what you learn. And yes, it could be scary what you might learn. But if you become aware of something, have the courage and faith to bring it to Jesus and let him wipe the dirt from your face with you. Listen again to those words out of Psalm 32. Blessed is the person whose transgression is forgiven, whose sins are covered, taken care of. Blessed is the person whose sin the Lord does not count against them because of Jesus, and in whose spirit is no deceit. That's a person who's looking to find the dirt. They're not fooling themselves. When I kept silent, said David, and he's talking about his sin, when I kept silent about my sin, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. That's that inner displeasure. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My strength was sapped as in the heat of summer. But then you forgave my sin, and life was restored. May that increasingly happen for all and each of us. And God's people said, Amen.